When going through times of trouble, it can be difficult to focus on anything else. But if God and faith are greater than our troubles, there can actually be joy when no one would expect it. Pastor Leith Anderson helps us find reasons for joy in his message, Rejoice During Troubles.
I'm on the email distribution list for a friend who is a former star of the National Football League. Late last year, I received an email from him that has to be one of the most excited and joyful and enthusiastic emails that I have ever read of the thousands of emails that I have read. He was reporting that he had just been diagnosed with cancer. And to use his words, he said, "I'm totally pumped by this diagnosis and can't wait to see how God is going to use this in my life." And I sat at my desk and read the computer monitor and thought to myself, this guy is either out of his mind with self-delusion, or he is onto something that every one of us need to know something more about. 1 Peter 1:6 says, "In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials." Now, it seems to me that rejoicing is usually for absolutely the best times in our lives, and that when troubles strike, when bad things happen to us, it is then that we want to cry and scream and complain and try to find somebody else that we can blame. But very few people throw a party when things go terribly wrong. So what's the Bible here trying to teach us? I mean, are we supposed to just fake it? Are we supposed to plaster a happy expression on our faces when we are deeply disappointed by life and somehow pretend because we are Christians and because we have faith that everything is just fine and good? It seems to me that the only way that we can genuinely rejoice in troubles is to have good stuff in our lives that outweighs the bad stuff in our lives. So let's suppose that one day your neighbor skids on the road in front of your house, slides into your driveway at far too great a speed, smashes your brand new car, careens off the car, and then goes into the house and parks in your kitchen. That's a bad day when things like that happen. But suppose that simultaneously, the mail carrier comes and hand delivers to you a check unexpected for $1 million while the telephone rings telling you that you won the Nobel Prize, and then your daughter comes running into the room saying that she has just been accepted at Oxford on a full scholarship. So is this a good day or is this a bad day? You've sort of got to weigh both and then make your own decision of whether or not the troubles are what you're going to complain about or the good things are what you're going to rejoice about. Peter's point in what he here writes is that Christians always have reasons for rejoicing that are greater than our reasons for feeling miserable. Of course, that means that every one of us has to decide for ourselves. We need to take the balance scales of life and figure out whether the problems are greater or the blessings are greater. And if the problems are greater, that's when we're going to become depressed and angry and disappointed and overwhelmed. And if the blessings are greater, that is when we're going to rejoice. So this evening we take a look at what Peter has to say in 1 Peter 1:3-12. It is the second of the 20 principles that he writes in the 5 chapters of the book that's named after him. He gives 6 reasons to rejoice, and he assumes that these reasons are great enough to outweigh any troubles that any of us may have in life. But he is not saying that our problems aren't real. He's not saying that our difficulties aren't great, but that the reasons for good are enough to give us hope in order to, even when we suffer grief in all kinds of trials, to still be able to rejoice. Well, let's check out his reasons. Reason number 1 that Peter gives
is the new birth, that we should rejoice because of new birth. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy, he has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. So the first and greatest step toward rejoicing in every situation is new birth into a living hope. Hope. Hope is something that we all need in order to go on. Maybe you're familiar with the story of Viktor Frankl, who was a Viennese psychiatrist, a Jew who was incarcerated at the death camp in Auschwitz. And he used his professional skills to analyze what was going on there and later wrote a book in which he said the determining factor between those who simply died, not that they were executed, but committed suicide or just died, was whether or not people had hope. He said you have to have hope to be able to go on in life, and we know that. Because when hope runs thin, when we run out of hope, it seems that we can go nowhere and our hearts are broken and there's no way that they can be healed. But praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ because he gives to us hope. That he is a God of mercy. He gives hope. He gives hope whether we deserve it or not. And he's generous. He gives to us whatever we need in order to have hope in large doses. And he does this in connection with a new birth. That is, that he is the God of second chances. He helps us start over again. That no matter how much we have messed up, no matter how great the failures or the problems, no matter how deep we are in the difficulties of life, we can have a new beginning and a new tomorrow, and we can go on. He'll give us hope that tomorrow can and will be better. So how does he do this? Well, God himself once faced a seemingly hopeless situation, hopeless even for God. His son died, and he was dead. I mean, really dead and buried day after day and night after night. And then God intervened and brought his son back to life again. And he proved that there can be hope for tomorrow, even when we're dead. That is absolutely astonishing. It is to say that if you have hope and a second chance, that's a reason to rejoice no matter what has gone wrong in our lives. That's not the only reason. He moves on and talks about an inheritance, knowing that we have riches coming, even if we are in financially tough times. That is to say that if I know that I can't pay my bills today, but that I have an inheritance that's coming tomorrow, that will cause me to view things differently. 1 Peter 1:4 speaks of an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade. And it's kept in heaven for you. It's promising that every Christian has a share in the wealth of God, that God has reserved for us resources and wealth that are more secure than any bank or Fidelity or Schwab or wherever we might invest any of the resources that we have. And that they're secure. They won't be eaten away by inflation. They won't be mishandled by Enron. The guarantee is that there won't be any mismanagement. There's no embezzlers or terrorists that can destroy it. It is so safe, this inheritance we have with God, that it can never perish, spoil, or fade. I grew up in a community that, at least on certain sides of the tracks, had some breathtakingly wealthy people. Some of them that I went to school with in junior high school and beyond were names of industry, famous names that were their family names. And they lived in these mansions and had servants and cars and elaborate vacation homes and levels of wealth that I still don't even begin to understand. So some of my classmates were from these exceptionally wealthy families. But, you know, on a day-to-day basis, at least in that point in life, there really wasn't much difference between any of us. We all kind of wore the same kind of clothes. We went to the same sporting events. We were in the same classrooms. We were all pretty much the same. But as we got older into our teenage years, every now and then, some of us that came from families that didn't have money liked to talk about the money that these other families had. And our classmates would then complain and say, a lot of good this does me. So what if I've got a trust? So what if, so, you know, when I'm old at 21 or something like that, I'm going to inherit a whole lot of money. What good does that do me now? It's no good at all. It's just worthless. I might as well not have it. But, you know, that simply wasn't true. You know, their lives were different. Just the prospect of what they would someday get affected the schools that they would attend, the careers they would follow, many of the friendships they made, the people they married. All kinds of things were impacted, even though they didn't immediately have access to the inheritance that would someday be theirs. As Christians, sometimes we are tempted to say, in the midst of our troubles and difficulties, what good does it do me that I have this inheritance from God in heaven? So what? That doesn't pay bills. That doesn't take care of rent. That doesn't change anything. But you know, the truth is that an inheritance in heaven does make a difference here and now. That as Christians, we know that no matter how hard it gets, someday we will be rich. That no matter how bad things are, someday we will have it made. And the experience, honestly, of most Christians is that God gives advances on the inheritance, that when we are up against it, that God intervenes and he provides when ends don't meet and he takes care of us. So let's face it, rejoicing in troubles makes a whole lot more sense when you know for sure that you have an inheritance from God that is waiting for you in heaven. But that's only the second of six reasons. The third is divine protection, that God indeed has a future promise and great plans for us, but he is also engaged in our lives in what we have happening here and now. And I think that there's a concept here that is hard to explain, at least it's hard for me to explain. And that is that I tend to think of what goes wrong in my life. That tends to be a focus, maybe an unfortunate focus, but a real focus. So I ask you, so what's gone wrong lately for you? It doesn't have to be just this past week. I mean, in recent weeks and months, there's been a health problem. There's a difficulty with a job, either because of layoffs or because of jobs that are being lost, or there's a problem with a family member or a relationship, or what, you know, all those things. We've all got those difficulties. This past week, we got a form in the mail. Charlie and I are in the process of refinancing the mortgage on our house to get a lower interest rate. So we got these forms to sign. And, you know, it didn't totally bother me that they had my Social Security number wrong. And I tried to get over it that they misrepresented my years of employment and my income and numerous other facts about me. I was irritated that in every page of these many, many forms, they misspelled her name. So I went through with a red marker. You know, I wanted to be subtle about it and corrected all the spelling all the way through. So, you know, I wasn't too much bothered about this, but I'll tell you the part that bothered me was that section where they listed me as a female, where they said that she was a male, where they identified us not only with the wrong gender, but with the wrong race, and they mixed up the races. And I was beginning to wonder who exactly was applying for this new mortgage. And I was kind of irritated by that this past week. Okay, now I've got that off my chest. But so what happened to you? You know, what happened to you this past week? What really irritated you? Now, you know you've got the answer because it's right there. That's the easy question. But to get this concept, let's try the tougher question. What didn't go wrong this past week? Of all the things that could have gone wrong, what didn't? Okay, now I don't mean that you weren't attacked by a crocodile on the first day that we dropped below zero. Now, I'm not talking about of all of the possibilities, but of the things that could have gone wrong, what didn't? You could have been in a fatal car crash. Remember when you were driving down the highway and that other car came really close and you didn't hit, but it was almost a near miss? You could have been laid off this week. You could have dated and married the wrong person. You weren't diagnosed with a disease. You didn't undergo a terrible, evil attack from Satan. The business meeting that you dreaded that was going to be the worst experience of your life turned out to not be so bad after all. And then you begin to realize all of the things that were near misses and could have gone wrong that didn't. You say, well, I don't much want to dwell on what didn't, but what happened there? What happened was you trusted God. You had faith, and God protected you from 100 dangers that now that you think about it, didn't happen. But add to that maybe a million other dangers that you never could imagine, that could have gone terribly wrong, but that God intervened, that God was watching out for you, whether you knew it or not. We, through faith, are shielded by God's power until the coming of salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time, that God has committed to get us through anything and everything that is dangerous and evil, that he constantly watches out for us, that he protects us, that he shields us from dangers that we don't even know anything about. I mean, that is good. That is marvelously good. It is a cause for rejoicing. And the point that is here being made is that instead of just crying and complaining over what did go wrong, that we ought to rejoice over what didn't go wrong, of how much God has provided and taken care of us. Add to that a fourth reason. Peter says that we should rejoice because we have faith that works. So let's talk about faith. Because God just loves faith. Faith is trusting God. It's believing in him. It's depending upon him. Because God is supernatural and God is great, and he just loves for us to trust us. Trust him. He loves for us to depend upon him. And one of the things that God does is he gives us more and more faith. Now, you're probably familiar with a financial and mathematical concept that is called the law of compounding. And even though you can't now, in most cases, get 7% return on your savings, just remember that once there were, and probably again, there will be times, and you probably know the law of compounding that says if you get a 7% return on your money, it will double in 10 years. If you're fortunate enough to be able to get a 10% return on your money, then it will double in 7 years. So all you do is entrust your money to the bank, and they just keep adding to it. They just keep doubling it. They keep increasing it. They just add more and more and more money to it until over a period of time, it grows enormously. And that's what God does with faith. It is the law of compounding when applied to faith, that God loves it when we trust him, and we trust him, we give it to him, and he just grows it so faith is greater. And faith is very valuable. It's more valuable than money. It's worth more than gold or any other assets, because all other assets will eventually disappear. They won't be around, but faith keeps going, and faith keeps growing, and it's fabulous. But if you're into checking out your money, you know that every now and then you need to have an audit. You need to make sure that the money is really there. You need to make sure that the bank is a safe bank. You need to make sure that you have a paper trail of the money that you have deposited there, or that the company that you have invested in is a credible company. So what you do is you go and you test it. And the same thing is true with faith. There come times in our lives when we've got this faith that we really trust God, but we better check it out. We better make sure that it's really there. It needs to be audited. It's kind of like the smoke detector in your house. Every now and then you push the button and see if it works. And it has this ear-piercing sound, and it may be kind of annoying at the time, but you know that it's dependable and it's there and everything is okay. And there come times in our lives when our faith is tested, when it's checked out and audited to see if it'll work. And it will. It will. Faith works. I've seen Christians worry that somehow when they face the worst difficulties of their lives, they will not trust God and they are going to cave in when life becomes really difficult. And I will tell you that my experience and observation is that Christians don't much do that. That even Christians that seemingly have weak faith are stunningly trusting of God when the greatest crises came, because Christian faith works. Christians really believe in God and really depend upon God, and especially so when audited in indescribable hardships. Peter puts it this way: these have come so that your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes and even though it's refined by fire. These have come so that your faith may be proved genuine and may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. So here's what happens. Christians face problems. Christians trust God. Faith works. God takes care of us. It really works. We pass the test. We get this great audit report, and it is a wonderful reason to rejoice, to be a Christian who has faith that actually works. Fifth on Peter's list is Jesus. Jesus himself. The Christians get Jesus. Sometimes maybe you think it would be better if we could see him, you know? If we could just see Jesus, if we could just touch him. It would just be fun if everything that we're going to experience in heaven could somehow be experienced even briefly here on earth. But of course, that wouldn't take faith. So here's the deal. We believe as Christians in Jesus, even though we can't currently see him or touch him. So we believe in him and we love him, even though we can't currently see him and touch him. It's like a woman who is pregnant and she loves the baby that she's never even seen or held. It's like the sweetheart who has someone off at war in a distant country in the army and loves that person even though far out of sight. Yeah, there would be a preference that we could see Jesus face to face in our salvation. But you know, we have him. We have him and he is real. He's just as real as if we could grab hold of him here and now. That we are his and he is ours, and that's as good as it gets. And that we have Jesus and love him is a reason, a powerful reason to rejoice, even when things in our lives seem to be down in the pits. Peter says, though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy. For you are receiving the goal of your faith, the salvation of your souls. And that leads to the last one on the list of Peter's reasons to rejoice, even when life is full of troubles. And that is this supernatural salvation, which is kind of like a treasure chest. You know, the pirates and the treasure hunters look far in order to find this buried treasure. Open the chest, and it's full of diamonds and gold and jewelry and has all of this value. And the Bible is here saying that people who are seekers, people who want all that God has to offer are searching out for this salvation that is like it. It's this fabulous treasure. And when we find this treasure of salvation, it's suddenly that we're no longer lost, but we're found. That it's when we quit being sinners and start being saints. It's when we quit being centered upon ourselves and we're centered upon God. It's when we quit moving away from God and move increasingly toward God and toward heaven. And all of that is very, very good. But best of all is that we have found this. As Christians, we've already got this salvation, this treasure that is indescribable. And it's through Jesus. Well, Peter says it like this. Concerning this salvation, the prophets who spoke of the grace that was to come to you searched intently like treasure hunters and with the greatest care trying to find out the time and the circumstances to which the Spirit of Christ in them was pointing when he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories that would follow. It was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves but you. When they spoke of the things that have now been told you by those who have preached the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven. Even angels long to look into these things. The angels of heaven are, wow, wow. Those Christians, they found the treasure. They've found salvation with all that that involves. You know, it's true that the day we find the treasure, maybe a day that we break a leg or lose a job or have a relationship broken. It may be that there are things that day that are terribly difficult and terribly painful, but we still rejoice because we have found the treasure of supernatural salvation. All right, here's what I propose. You've got a ledger sheet, And there are two columns on that ledger sheet. What I invite you to do is in the left column, add it up. Add up all your problems and all of your pains and all of your difficulties and all of your worries and get a total. As best you can, come up with a total. Are these problems real? Oh, they're real. Are they difficult? For some of us, they are indescribably difficult. Are they harsh? Sometimes we wonder if we can face them and still go on. All of that because Christians are not exempt. We are not exempt from the troubles and problems, and sometimes for us, the total of that column is absolutely staggering. But before you leave the ledger sheet, add up the right column, the next column. The Bible asks for us to add together our new birth, eternal inheritance, divine protection, faith that works, Jesus himself, and supernatural salvation. Add it all up. And what's the total that you get? Are these things real? Yeah, they're real. And the total is far higher than the total in the left column, than all of our troubles. Not that the troubles aren't real, but that this total is a greater total, and therein we rejoice. We rejoice that God has given to us the bigger number, and he calls upon us to celebrate the blessings, to rejoice even during troubles. And so, our God, we do. We lift up our hands and our lives and our lips to praise and to thank and to acknowledge you, saying that the problems of our lives are difficult. They are problems that are real. But you are a God who is great. You are the God who is holy and almighty. You are the one who is to receive the highest praise. Honor and glory be unto your name.
Wooddale Church is located at 6630 Shady Oak Road in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. Please call us at 952-944-6300 or visit us on the internet at www.wooddale.org.
For our faith story this evening, we meet one of the most fascinating people you could ever meet. She was born in Vietnam and learned Vietnamese, and came to the United States and learned English, then went to Africa and learned an exotic language, and now lives in, who would have guessed, Siberia. Please welcome Kim Lee.
I believe being a child of God is the most wonderful thing in life. So my heart desire has always been to help others discover a relationship with God too. The Bible verse which God had used to ask me consider taking the good news of Jesus Christ to people in other parts of the world was Isaiah 49:6. I will make you a light for the Gentiles, that you may bring my salvation to the ends of the earth. I took it to heart. Little did I know that my first missionary assignment would be working as a Wycliffe Bible translator in the Sahara Desert in West Africa, just outside of Timbuktu. Famine was a constant part of life there, and infectious diseases of any kind, you name it, were there. Many people back home here pray for me and for my work. My translation task was the biggest project in Africa, yet it progressed in a way that only God could have done it. Only God could make it happen. People there accepted me as one of their own. I was so excited about the ministry, and I thought that I would live there for the rest of my life. Well, God has his own plan. At the end of my 10th year working in Africa, he moved me to the other end of the earth. Siberia, from one of the hottest places on earth to one of the coldest places on earth. I'm currently a missionary with CIM in Irkut, Siberia. CIM stands for Church Resource Ministries. Our mission is to develop and train leaders to strengthen and start churches in America and around the world. Where is Irkut? is 14 time zones east from here. Yakut is considered by Russians as the Pearl of Siberia. It's an intellectual city with more than 25 universities. During the 70 years of communism, the region of Irkutsk had functioned as a huge prison cell. Thousands of people had been exiled there for political or religious reasons. They have suffered a lot of emotional scars and pain. For me to share the good news of Jesus Christ with them, I had to earn the right to speak through trusting relationships. Again, many people back home here pray for me and for the ministry. I learned the Russian language, and people came to trust me and listen to me. I have seen nothing short of God's miracles during the past 3 years. The platform of my ministry in Irkutsk has been my two-room apartment. It's a busy place where several times a week I invite people in for meals, tea, discussions, and Bible studies. My Russian friends really, really enjoy my home. They think it's a restful and safe place. During the course of 3 years, 19 people, one by one, have prayed with me to become followers of Jesus Christ. And second-generation Christians are starting to be produced through them. Last year, I asked you to pray that God would give me a few faithful, available, accountable, and teachable people to disciple and train. God did just that. He gave me one man and four women. During the past year, I have discipled, trained them, and they are now functioning as leaders of the church, Church of Faith, Hope, and Love. I am so ever grateful to God for the way he has worked in my life and prepared me for every step of service. I have to say the next best gift God has given me after salvation is prayer counseling. I initially received training in prayer counseling 6 years ago, not knowing that this would become an essential tool in my discipleship and training process among Russians. People's lives there are so shattered. Alcoholism, drugs, incest, promiscuity, and abuse of all forms and shapes are the norm of life there. As I disciple and mentor people, I incorporate prayer counseling as an essential part of the process to bring about healing and restoring shattered lives to wholeness. Olga is one of the four women from our church who has asked me to take her through prayer counseling. Olga is 33 years old. She has a great and tender heart. However, she has suffered so much in life. And from this, she has distorted ideas about life in her growing up years and in a marriage to an abusive, alcoholic husband. Olga considers me as her best trusted friend and mom. I spent about 36 hours with her in prayer counseling. Each session was filled with tears and pain as the Holy Spirit convicted her of her own sins and the sins of those involved. He also revealed distorted views in her life and helped her replace these lies with God's truth. The result is a light, pure, clean Olga who understands that she is a precious daughter of God. She said to me, "My mother gave me life, but you have taught me how to live it." Olga is now filled with energy and joy, capable of living life abundantly and caring for her 8-year-old daughter. She is a faithful leader in our church. God is her trusted father, and she wants to help others know him too. This is just one story. This is just one person whose life has been restored to wholeness by God through prayer counseling. Again, I'm grateful to God for the part he allows me to do in advancing his kingdom in Siberia. I'm grateful to God for your loving support in finance and prayers. for me, for my ministry, and for the people in Irkutsk. To God be the glories.